Autumn in America offers us so much: crisp air and beautiful leaves and the smashing of human bodies into one another with great force. Fall just wouldn't be fall for a lot of people without football, specifically college football. Plenty of people who can't spell baccalaureate still want their team to mete out a good pounding to a rival university on the next Saturday. Our guest today regards herself among the fans, but also brings up many issues facing college football in her book Tribal: College Football and the Secret Heart of America. Diane Roberts teaches literature and creative writing at Florida State University, holds a PhD from Oxford, contributes to Oxford American, The Guardian, NPR, and other sites and publications, and she holds season tickets to see Florida State football games. Florida State lost to Oregon in one of last year's national semifinals. Diane Roberts, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Even when we talk about problems with football, we still get competitive with me talking about the Oregon-Florida State semifinal.
I was going to say, you did bring up Oregon. You did. And I was going to congratulate you on a really wild win last night. That was something else.
I wish I could say I'd seen it.
Three overtimes. I'll just say three.
I heard, yeah, but a wild final score up in the 50s. It sounded like a basketball score.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was crazy, but I enjoyed it. It's beautiful football.
This is a great example, though, of where you and lots of other people are coming from. You see all the warts that come with the game of football. I mean, the violence contained barely on the field. A lot of events going on off the field, and yet we still want to talk about what happened in last night's game.
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing, but humans are contradictory creatures, aren't they? We tend to be able to, maybe it's compartmentalizing, or maybe it's just holding opposing ideas in our heads, but we have a talent for it. And when it comes to college football, I think that's useful, because if you think yourself all the way out of it, then I think, you know, you would kind of miss the game. At least I would. But if you don't question it and don't examine it, then you're missing some pretty dreadful things that go on.
You spent 10 years in England. Did you not develop a passion for soccer? I mean, Watford's not that far away, right?
Well, actually, Oxford has its own team. We have Oxford United.
All right.
There used to be two. There was Oxford United and Oxford City. But and if Oxford City still exists, somebody will probably call up and correct me. But no, I didn't. I enjoy it. I mean, I admire it. I think it's a very elegant game and a very fast game. But it's not my game. And I loved rugby, and I went to the Oxford-Cambridge match every year at Twickenham, called the varsity match. And I loved that game too, but again, it wasn't my game, and I thought I would get over college football then, and I didn't. So
this really goes back
to an addiction.
Absolutely, and it goes back to your birth household, as you point out. Take us back to the formation of the Seminole sentiment in your household.
Well, I grew up in a slightly unusual household in that my father was a University of Florida Gator, the great rivals of Florida State University, but he converted to Seminoleism, as it were. I think my mother worked on him rather subtly, and he decided he would be a Seminole, and they went to games all the time. I was a little child. They went to away games. They went to home games. They dressed beautifully for the games. This was back when people dressed for football games in the South as if it was church, and some people still do that. It's a nice thing to see. Hats, gloves, coats, ties, the whole nine yards. And when my father died, I inherited his season tickets. So I went to games with my mother and my godparents, and nobody thought that was weird until I got much older and started thinking about it and thought, yeah, that's a little weird.
Does it extend to a professional life? I mean, would you ever refuse a job at the University of Florida?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
It's a great university. In fact, I interviewed for a job at the University of Florida, but they had better people than I at the time, so I didn't get it. But it's a terrific university. It's a lovely town it's in, Gainesville. You know, though around this time of year, I start talking about Gainesville with its old name, which was Hogtown. We enjoy doing that.
The Florida game must be coming up soon.
It's at the end of November, but it's never too soon to start spewing irrational hatred.
You do have a way of turning a phrase both in life and in the book. In fact, the one in the book that really caught my eye is the game's in bed with fundamentalist Christianity, anti-intellectualism, and retrograde ideas about women and people of color. Whew, let's break that apart. Let's talk about the fundamentalist Christianity first.
Well, I am very much aware, both from doing research and from just hanging out, that a lot of people in the stands are much, much, much more conservative than I am. If you look at the demographics for advertising, those who want to advertise to conservative, evangelical, white Republicans should advertise during college football games. That's how you'll reach them. The game also is very entangled with an operation called the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and they provide a great many chaplains to football teams. Now, I don't know if this pertains as much in the West, where I think there's a slightly different cultural thing, though the Fellowship of Christian Athletes does exist very much in the West as well, and in the Northwest to some extent. But, you know, the golf team doesn't have a chaplain, and lots of other sports don't have chaplains, but football teams tend to have chaplains. And the chaplain at Florida State and many other Southern universities and Midwestern universities is actually on the sidelines while the game's playing. And when a boy comes off having done something stupid, the chaplain will go over there and pray with him.
And you point out some other ways in which they've gotten around the church-state separation thing at some schools. Just give them a title that doesn't make them sound like a chaplain. But lots more stories like that in the book Tribal, College Football and the Secret Heart of America. Diane Roberts wrote it and is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Diane and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to get in on the conversation. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Football Saturdays in autumn, a big deal for fans of college football, but there's a lot of darkness in college football as well. Diane Roberts acknowledges both sides of the equation in her book, Tribal, College Football and the Secret Heart of America. She is herself conflicted as a staunch supporter of Florida State University, where she works, and also a recognizer of some of the things that have gone specifically at FSU, including with their Heisman Trophy winning quarterback of 2 years ago. We can talk about the specifics. We can talk about general trends. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. All right, so back to the phrase, the game's in bed with fundamentalist Christianity. Anti-intellectualism was the next thing. You know, it's clear that so many of the people who cheer for these teams had probably never set foot on the university campus other than around the football stadium.
This is true. Or if they did, you know, college was a thing that they, it was just more school for 4 years, and then they got out of school and they got a job. And, you know, it's not like they sat down and wrote poetry on the weekends. Some do, but a lot of people don't. Education is more and more seen as vocational rather than turning people into smart citizens, which is a shame. But really, when you get outside of that, you have a lot of people who don't, they've never been to college, they have no intention of going to college, not interested in college, they just like college football. In Alabama, the slightly mean phrase for them is dirt road alumni.
I saw that.
And, you know, in Alabama, where I used to teach at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, which is a wonderful, wonderful place. And, you know, I was amazed to read once in one of the Alabama papers that most Alabamians do not have a college degree, yet most Alabamians have chosen a side in the Alabama-Auburn rivalry.
It's one or the other. Yeah, I lived in Huntsville for a couple of years.
Oh, yeah, then you know. And that is the most rabid thing ever. That is more rabid than Florida State and Florida. It's older than Florida State and Florida, so it just got rabid fast.
And it leads to things that go beyond just mischief. You get into the discussion of Toomer's Oaks, these famous trees in Auburn. What happened there?
Oh, Lord, this is a very sad and at the same time completely hilarious story. There's a little sort of patch ground in Auburn, which is a very small town. A couple of lovely oak trees stood there. And it's called the Auburn family. The Auburn family loved those oak trees because after a big win, they would go and hurl rolls of toilet paper at them and therefore celebrate. And it made the trees look, I guess, real festive. And a mad in the sense of angry and maybe crazy, Alabama fan, after a particularly heartbreaking loss to Auburn, drove to Auburn with a herbicide, very powerful herbicide, and poisoned the trees. And this was a shocking thing. The trees could not be saved. People at the University of Alabama were also shocked, most of them, not all of them. And they were appalled because oak trees, for whatever reason, are much loved in Alabama. Everybody loves oak trees. Oak trees are special and revered. So there was a group set up in Tuscaloosa to raise money to replace the trees or save the trees. And I'll tell you, I think it probably advanced science because Auburn has a very great department of sort of agriculture and silviculture, and all of these tree scientists did everything they could to save the trees. Wasn't possible. Now there are new trees. The guy that did it called into the Paul Feinbaum radio show. I don't know if your listeners know Paul Feinbaum, but
he's a big deal in Alabama, and actually a guy from New York.
Of SEC football. He is the guy. He has a radio show that is kind of a masterpiece of performance art as well as sports journalism. And the guy confessed on radio and said he did it because he just had too much Bama in him. And this was much, much discussed and contemplated. In other words, too much Alabama. Mm-hmm. And he just was so angry at Auburn, largely because they beat Alabama, but also because some dreadful person put an Auburn jersey on the statue of the sainted Coach Bear Bryant in Tuscaloosa. And that was just too much. And he had to retaliate. And he actually did a little bit of jail time for this.
But it seems like some people in Alabama still regard this as a justifiable herbicide.
Yes, they do indeed regard it that way because, you know, there's just something, according to rabid Alabama fans, there's something so wrong and inherently evil and dreadful about Auburn that Auburn just should not exist. And they just, anything you can do to fight the creeping plague that is war eagle-ism is entirely meet and right. And if you ask an Auburn person, you can flip that around, and the same would be true of them with the University of Alabama. And, you know, it's completely and utterly crazy. You know, those poor, inoffensive trees, you know, they never did anything wrong. I should say, in between the trees being dead and removed, they did put up some nice big iron things so that Auburn fans had something to toilet paper, because that's the important part.
Right. You have to have a place to throw the teepee.
Do your festive thing out there. They also, the university, this is how smart universities are now, and this gets back to the religion question. They got whatever wood they could get out of the dead trees and put it into, they called them souvenirs, but I would call them reliquaries, because this was like owning a piece of the True Cross, except you got a piece of a tumor's tree, and for $29.95 you could have a little splinter, and you could actually have it in a little thing where you could open up the door, the glass door, and touch it. You know, that is a religious act, and I don't know that people prayed to it or anything, but having it in your home was an act of great devotion and loyalty to Auburn University. And this is not uncommon. This is a thing college football does, that people confuse it mightily with religion, and go to football games more faithfully than they go to church.
Is that in part because of the general cultural region of the country we're talking about? I mean, this is strongest in the South, where religion is strongest as well. I mean,
in the Midwest, Ohio State people would tell you, you know, they come second to no one in their football religiosity. But I'm sorry, I cut off your question.
Well, the point being that, for example, you can go to Cullman, Alabama, not far from Huntsville, where I lived, and there are like 60 churches in a town of about 10,000 people. You see that kind of religious emphasis more in the South, I think, than in other parts of the country, and therefore the football religious fervor seems to accompany it.
It does, and which is interesting, because if we think about, you know, Christianity, last I looked, is presided over by the Prince of Peace, and not a guy known for, you know, headbutting the apostles or, you know, taking Peter out in an open field tackle. And yet, football and Christianity are interwoven, for which we can either thank or blame, you take your pick, our British cousins and in some ways our British ancestors, because they delivered to us in the 19th century a movement called muscular Christianity. A lot of men, it was mostly men, were very, very worried that religion was getting too feminized, all that gentle Jesus, meek and mild stuff. And they didn't think that was a good idea. They thought, you know, Christianity needed to be more manly. And one of the ways you could be manly and religious was play sports for the glory of God. And so the YMCA comes out of this kind of thinking. Teddy Roosevelt loved this. Teddy Roosevelt pushed football under any and all circumstances because he thought it created manly men who could then spread, you know, American civilization throughout the world, the same way the British had thought, well, the British Empire needs very manly Christian guys, you know, muscled up, games playing, sports loving Christian guys to go and subdue the empire, as somebody said, with a Bible in one hand and a rifle in the other. So that's where a lot of it comes from. And I think in the South, where we still have extremely well-defined gender roles, and we tend to divide things into binary opposites, I think it just suited the South's sense of how the world should work. Men are men, women are ladies. You know, men play football, women cheer or twirl batons. And that's how the world should be. And they don't like the confusion that comes when you actually start blurring these roles. The same with religion. You know, God is God and everybody else is wrong. So it's sort of a older set of social attitudes, but it's also a defense mechanism against the ambiguities of the modern world.
Diane Roberts is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a professor at Florida State University and the author of Tribal, College Football and the Secret Heart of America. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. And there's a lot to talk about with college football. Or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have a call here from Steve and Eugene. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Exchange.
Howdy. Last year, our University of Oregon was in the BCS, and we had the Heisman. This year, we've lost three games already. Have you run across any coping mechanisms for such immediate reversals of fortune?
Oh, Steve, I feel your pain. Florida State has luckily only lost one game, but we will lose at least two more. My coping mechanism, because I was raised a Presbyterian, is to say suffering ennobles. No pain, no gain. Let's see, what are the ridiculous ideas? I actually am serious that I have learned as a Florida State fan to suffer. Florida State hasn't always been, you know, super good at football. When I was a kid, I remember sitting through a season that they went 0-11.
Ouch.
We nevertheless went to every football game, and when FSU kicked a field goal, we rejoiced as if it was a win because, hey, we wouldn't be shut out this time. And, you know, when you know you're really not very good, you can enjoy the games even more because everything is gravy. You know, the trouble is with FSU and Oregon, you know, Oregon, who I will remind everybody, as if they don't know, beat the tar out of FSU in the playoffs last year. Marcus Mariota was a thing to see. You know, you just have to go, we're not always going to be on top. You have to say to yourself, well, you know, we do good some years. We're not going to be great some years. It doesn't actually make it hurt less, but philosophically it sounds good. And if nothing else, you can get credit for being, you know, a good loser, which I try to do, except when it's the University of Florida. But I am doom-laden. Every week I say, we're going to lose, we're going to lose, we're going to lose. And I happened to be right last weekend, but, you know, I'm already saying Florida State plays Syracuse this weekend, so I'm saying it's okay, we're going to lose. It's good for us.
That's a good attitude. Let's take another call. We have Ryan and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Diane Roberts.
Well, this is a wonderful conversation. Thank you. Thank you again, Jeffrey and team. You know, my two lenses are, you know, I have been commuting for the last 21 years from Eugene, Oregon, the home of the Ducks, to Corvallis, Oregon, the home of the Beavers, all of 49 miles apart.
Wow.
And, you know, it's just wonderful. You know, I have to change my colors someplace in a mid-city called Junction City to make sure that I don't offend anybody, like by wearing my Rose Bowl T-shirt or something from the University of Oregon. And so, you know, there's that lens. But the other one that you've alluded to is that cultural lens, and I love the connection between the fundamentalism, but I think there's others as well. Certainly the gender roles and the sexism of the cheerleaders. You know, I was, my mother was an alumni of Stanford, season ticket holders during the Elway years, which was fun to run around and get beat a lot, but he was wonderful, obviously. But they also had to ban the Ohio State pyramid because it was simply dangerous to pile too many people too high and we're injuring people. And that, you know, that obliviousness of our culture is such a wonderful window. I love your descriptions. But it's an important window into some really interesting underpinnings, and whether that's the racism, whether that's the rampant sexism and violence associated with that, the steroid use, the concussions. So, you know, I am totally of both minds. I loved the game last night. I stayed up till midnight. I can't imagine anybody on the East Coast, actually.
Yeah, well, hello. It was too good to go to bed. It really was.
Oh, my gosh. But that was one of the wonderful games of young men, you know, playing, having fun, doing something really unique and wonderful that, you know, I wish my dad was still alive because I would have called him up this morning and we would have had a great conversation about football.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, just not about, you know, how we felt about each other or about whatever. It's kind of football and politics were our two.
But that it really might have been about how you felt about each other, because I know that it's not a coincidence that I was given my father's football tickets. I mean, my brother was too young at the time, but it was always assumed I would go to the football game and sit in the good seats, and maybe he would go with, you know, a couple kids in his Boy Scout troop and sit in the end zone if he got to go at all. My brother later played the game. But that I really feel that it's part of a connection to my father, who never played football. He was too small, and he had all kinds of health problems. But he ran track, and he was a manager for the football team at Florida State for a year before he transferred to the University of Florida. And it really is a way of connecting to your family, to your heritage. Maybe it's not considered by some people a very good way to do it, but I would argue with that. I mean, people that don't like the game would say, well, you know, can't you actually have a civilized conversation without it involving 19 and 20-year-old boys beating the hell out of each other? But, you know, this happens to be the cultural way that we might indeed do it. And I mean, I think that is actually valuable and good. And my father loved the game so much that, you know, he would just become a nervous wreck before it. He just couldn't. It's almost like he couldn't stand it at the same time that he loved it. And I'm almost that bad. And everybody in my family says, oh, God, she's just like her daddy. And I like that. That pleases me. And I like that there is that connection. And I also, the ambivalence is something that, you know, it sounds like, yeah, we expect people to be entirely committed to one position or another, but I think humans are actually ambivalent about things. And there's something about, you know, kicking, passing, carrying a ball around a field that we are hardwired to do. It's not an accident that this game is very old. You know, football is ancient in its sort of earlier forms. It didn't involve being able to touch the ball with your hands, but then in some cultures it did. I mean, it goes back oh God, at least 1,000 years. In Britain, they still play a game called mob football, one village versus another village. Rule number one is do not commit manslaughter, you know, because people used to get stabbed, and, you know, it was bad. It was pretty bad. But then, you know, it's a violent game. And there's something about violence that, though we don't want to admit it, and we wish we weren't like this, human beings also like that. You know, in America, boy, do we like violence. So, you know, there's a whole combination of things in there, some of which we celebrate and some of which we might be a little ashamed of. But it goes to make up who we are.
Let's talk about this more when we come back from the break. The book is called Tribal: College Football and the Secret Heart of America. Diane Roberts wrote it. She joins us from Florida State University. We'll come back and talk more with Diane and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Diane Roberts, who teaches literature and creative writing at Florida State University. She's got a PhD from Oxford, contributes to the Oxford American, The Guardian, NPR, and a lot of other organizations. She is talking today about her book, Tribal: College Football and the Secret Heart of America, in which she reveals her own obsession with college football, like a lot of other people in the Deep South, but also raises a lot of issues about the dark side of college football as well. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone around the region. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. I want to continue the history lesson just a bit, or as you put it, nothing says sexy like grappling in the freezing mud over a pig's bladder. You say part of the reason the Puritans left England was a disagreement over football?
This is one of the funniest things that I found out in research, and I think loads of people know this. I just didn't know it. The king at the time, James I of England and James VI of Scotland, he was a sports fan. He's the guy that, you know, is of Bible fame, that kind of King James, in the 17th century, loved sports. He said that bear baiting was not okay on the Sabbath, but after church you could go play football. Well, the Puritans, who did not hold with having fun on the Sabbath or much of any other time, said, no, that's violating the Lord's Day. You can't be doing that stuff. And the king wrote a book, actually, called The Book of Sports, where he said, yes, you can. Here are the appropriate sports. Here are the inappropriate sports. So you had to keep your bear baiting for weekdays, but football you could play on the Sabbath. And it's one of the reasons, there were a lot of reasons, that some of them flounced off to the New World and didn't hold with that football playing on Sunday. And little did they know, they were coming to a place when, you know, some of the most important games are played on Sundays. And so, gosh, that's some kind of karmic revenge on them, maybe. But they also moved to a continent where, lo and behold, the natives played all kinds of ball games. All kinds of ball games, sometimes, you know, benign ones, and sometimes the further south you went, some that were maybe, if you lost, you got your head cut off. And mostly they played with a pig's bladder or some other object every once in a while if it was a symbolic game. Apparently they'd been known to play with a severed head. So that's jolly. There we go, football with a serious edge.
So there's something to be said for what people get out of the physical stuff. I mean, running around and chucking a ball around is a lot of fun, but that speaks to the players. What do we as spectators get out of this sport, particularly when you get hatred of the like? I mean, I met people in Alabama who said their favorite teams were the Crimson Tide and whoever's playing Auburn this week. So, I mean, you've heard variations of this, I'm sure. But do we, I mean, does our brain get bathed in dopamine by hating Auburn or Oregon State or something?
Well, we underscore who we are. We say, you know, we are who we are because we're not those people that we have defined as bad. And the ridiculous thing about that is that it's always the people who are actually quite similar to us that we loathe and despise. So, you know, Auburn is not exactly a million miles from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. The people that live there look strikingly like the people that live in Tuscaloosa. And yet Alabama fans hate them, because somehow they embody all that is evil and not good in the world. The same with Florida State and the University of Florida, where, you know, most people can't even tell us apart because one is called the University of Florida and one of them is called Florida State University. I believe you have that similar issue in Oregon. We have an Oregon State and a University of Oregon, and people go, for heaven's sake, you know, why can't it just be one? At which point we all freak out, you know, argue frantically. But, you know, Gainesville, Florida is a nice university town. The university looks very similar to Florida State. It's red brick Gothic buildings. It has oak trees and Spanish moss. And, you know, if I'm looking at them from space, I'm thinking, well, what's the difference between these two places? And this is blasphemous because, of course, Gators are different from us. They're just terrible people, except for a few. And one of my best friends really is a Gator. But this is what we do. And I think this is a very primitive thing. I think that it may have been a survival mechanism to decide that, you know, your clan was good and you trusted them, but that clan over there in the next cave, not good. You had to watch those people. They'd be coming for your saber-toothed tiger meat or whatever it was. And so you defined yourself against small groups next to you. You know, there's no point. You cannot work up. Nobody at Florida State, even after the game last year, could work up anything like hatred for Oregon. You know, there was mild attempt to make fun of the fact that they're called the Ducks, which any rational person actually thinks is great. I think it's really cool they're called the Ducks. But other than that, like, we don't have a history with Oregon. Many of us can't find Oregon on a map, I'm sorry to say. We don't know what happens there. We don't know the difference between Oregon and Washington, which I'm sure will hurt people's feelings. And, I mean, it's just, it is a human thing to divide yourself into a group and say, this is my group, and these other guys are not right. There are just so many things wrong with them, and they don't like the right things, and they don't behave in a way that I find appropriate. And, you know, I kept hearing, one of the reasons I wrote the book is that I got annoyed hearing that, you know, politics has divided America in a way that we've never seen before. And I thought, that's not right. College football beat political division by at least 100 years. I mean, the hatred between Michigan and Ohio State is so old. You know, it's over 100, God, it's 120-something years old at least. South Carolina, the University of South Carolina, and Clemson University, they got to the point in 1902 where they were advancing on each other with guns.
Wow.
People had to step in because, you know, Clemson had lost and the South Carolina people were making fun of them, and it distressed them, and the Clemson boys went home and got their firearms. So, you know, football is a way of expressing this distrust and dislike of whoever you decide to claim is the enemy.
Right, your tribe, and yeah. Hence the title of the book, Tribal.
Indeed.
So, but, you know, the effect gets into areas, though, where because you have fanaticism, which is where the word fan comes from, as you remind us, you get a lot of financial support for football programs. I think you pointed out that FSU Stadium is getting renovated for $81 million, but what, for example, is happening to academic programs on campus?
Well, though I disapprove of all the money being spent on, say, the stadium, which is already pretty palatial, frankly, it doesn't take the money away in a literal sense. Most of the money that football brings in goes back into football. What it does do is de-emphasize academics. And in a state university, I don't know if it works this way in Oregon, but certainly in Florida, getting the attention of the state legislature so that, you know, they might carry on funding your College of Arts and Sciences, which seems a little bit vital, you know, might depend on them loving the football. But then, you know, they don't really care about the College of Arts and Sciences. They care about the football. So people don't pay attention to the real things the university does. Very few kids play football, and, you know, good for those that do, mostly good. But, you know, what about all these other kids that are trying to get an education? And that is somewhat denigrated. I like to point out that I teach in a department that we have a Pulitzer Prize winner. We have a National Book Award winner. those gentlemen who are extremely renowned authors will never get a salary that approaches that of an assistant strength coach. They just will not. And, you know, we don't get private money coming in to supplement our salaries the way that the athletic department does. This is not a thing I think that the rest of us particularly resent. We don't, you know, sit around fuming because we don't make what the coach makes. And the coach at Florida State makes $4+ million a year. No English professor anywhere is going to make that kind of money. But, you know, it does sort of show you what matters. And what matters in this society is this big money sport of football. Other coaches, of course, don't make that kind of money. And I think that it just, again, I don't know that I want to rant and rave about it, but I do want to point it out because I think it's interesting and because I think it speaks to our priorities.
Mm-hmm. We have an email here from Mike in Medford who says, for years I noticed the extreme amount of patriotism at football games. I recently found out the military pays the NFL for their massive display of military patriotism. Is it the same in the NCAA? I just want to watch sports. These patriotic military displays seriously verge on fascism. I sometimes feel like I'm watching the Berlin Olympics in 1936. The pregame feels like a warm-up to a Republican debate. That from Mike in Medford.
I congratulate Mike. He should be writing. Maybe he does. That's a great way to put it. Yeah, we have flyovers at football games. We have the Red Arrows or whatever they are come over. We have parachute jumps, military parachute jumps. We have color guards. We have loads of militaristic things. Some places have cannons on their fields. Florida State lacks a cannon, but we do have fireworks. And, you know, if you catch it at just the right moment with the flyovers and the parachuting and the fireworks and the color guard, it can look like a, you know, tough night in Damascus. And the fascism is well taken as a point. I occasionally worry about being one of 80+ thousand people all chanting the same thing in the stadium, making the same hand movement. It isn't quite Sieg Heil, but
the tomahawk chop, yeah, it's pretty close.
Thing. You know, and I think this is bordering on fascism, and it is very patriotic, and it's because football is the next best thing we have to war. You know, football is a warlike game. We use these metaphors, which are very military. You know, the quarterback is a field general. He throws the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
No, that all of this stuff. And it's about conquest. You know, it's often been pointed out that baseball is a pastoral game where you go around the bases and you come home. There's a wonderful old George Carlin routine about football and baseball. I love that the whole point of baseball, George Carlin says, is to be safe at home. And in football, it's to conquer the other guy's territory and to, you know, crush him. And it just is this amazing thing. And it might be why football lovers, college football lovers, are much, much, much more conservative than I am on the whole. Not all of them, of course, but preponderance of them, much more conservative, more likely to vote Republican, though it is, at least in the South, it's kind of not the done thing to bring football and politics together, not at the stadium. That's not okay.
Yeah, you point out some interesting moments where that gets smoothed over.
Oh,
we have about
yeah.
2 minutes left, Diane. I want to get on to the gender bowl. You have the book divided up into quarters and a halftime show. As a feminist, what troubles you the most in football?
Well, it's actually the language of it, more than the fact that, in general, men play it and women don't. The cheerleaders, while there's this strange phenomenon of them wearing great big old bows on their heads, and they are all very pretty and they wear lovely makeup. Those young women are actually terrific athletes. They're gymnasts on the whole. They are every bit as athletic as those football players are. They're just much smaller and bouncier. So that part, you know, I think if a woman wants to play football, she should be allowed to play football, and that has happened in a few places, not in the South. But it's happened. It will happen more.
With great resistance, though, from the men, right?
Oh, with huge resistance. But the language of it is always, you know, coach calls players when he's mad at them ladies or girls. You know, they're said to throw, you know, quarterback who doesn't have a good arm throws like a girl. I'd kind of like to see, not that it's her sport, but I'd like to see Serena Williams get in there and throw. I'll bet she could throw in a way that would not be described as like a girl. And I think that denigrating language and the whole spectacle, which is that women are on the sidelines while men are doing things, is problematic. You know, and why it is that we need young ladies in skin-tight sequins throwing batons around, I don't know. Other countries play sports and manage to get along without that. I am not calling for the abolition of majorettes. I enjoy watching majorettes throw knives and lit up batons, you know, fire batons.
Right.
That's real cool stuff. But still, it's weird when you look at it, like, what is this about again? What are we celebrating here? And I think as a feminist, I have a lot of problems with the way that the game simply says, this is what a man is. He is large and violent. And what a woman is this person that stands on the sideline going, you did beautifully, I love you no matter what.
I could go for 10 minutes on the bows on the head myself, but we're out of time here. The book is called Tribal, College Football and the Secret Heart of America. Diane Roberts wrote it and joined us today. Diane, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a great conversation.
All right, take care. That'll do it for today's exchange. You can find out more about the program at jeffexchange.org. Follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Jeff Exchange.